Narniwebbers, welcome back to the Narniweb Council, our continuing unfolding saga of the Narniweb commentary on Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Rillian is still not back. He's still busy, but he'll definitely be back very soon. Managed to get through the previous episode without Rillian, so I'm hoping we can do it again. Today we've got Dr. Elwyn Ransom. What's up, Doc?
Reprising my seat on the throne of the ancient and highly esteemed Narniweb Council. How are you, Glumpuddle?
Doing well this time. I'm doing just as well as I was last week when he recorded this podcast for the first time. And somebody deleted their audio, that somebody being me. So this is our second attempt at this episode. That's why it's been so long. So we've definitely kind of – we had one attempt to kind of get all the issues out. Now we have another shot at making it more better or cohesive or something, I guess.
Which means it's a take two, which means that we'll probably do a much better job. And
I hope
hey,
so.
Yeah, but we don't mind talking about all of this all over again because, hey,
right.
we get to sit together and jaw about Narnia, which is always a
that's
fun thing to do.
That's right. Now, a little disclaimer I want to say here. There is going to be some negativity in this one because Ransom and I have rather negative feelings towards this part of the film, but I am going to I'm kind of looking through the forum right now because there are a lot of Narniwebbers who liked this part of the movie, so I'm going to try to make sure I'm fair and kind of make sure their opinions are heard as much as I can. So a little disclaimer there. I apologize those of you who, you know, are very positive and there's a lot of negative stuff in this one. But what can you do? So
Make an effort to bring out the positive parts, and of course you're welcome to challenge us in the comments, which has certainly happened before. Or
please
if
do.
You get really irked, pull out your earphones, set your iPhone or whatever it is aside and throw rotten fruit at it.
You could do that too. I would hope that even people who disagree still get some enjoyment out of listening to us. That's always the hope. So yes, please comment if whether you agree or disagree, please, we want to hear your thoughts. When Jim Finn and I left off in the previous episode, we just finished off the Koryakin dialogue scene where he basically set up the rest of the movie with the seven swords and everything. And then we cut to a storm sequence, sort of a montage of Eustace writing in his journal. We see Reepy Cheep standing on the prow. I thought that was a really, really cool shot of Reepy Cheep.
I enjoyed that shot too. The effects were really good from what I remember. Of course, having not had Reepy Cheep's yearning for this voyage set up before might have weakened it a little bit, and I can't help but think how much more powerful it would have been had we learned more of why Reepy Cheep is so gung-ho on this. Obviously, he's not keen to go running around picking up seven swords. We'd had the conversation earlier about how Reepy Cheep has a greater hope that even than finding the seven lost swords, it might have made this an even more powerful moment, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think here they're just basically saying, well, look at how brave this mouse is, which in Reepy Cheep's simplest form, as far as the character, he's a mouse who fights and is brave. You know, that's kind of what people remember about Reepy Cheep.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just, oh, wow, look at how brave he is what I took away from it. But yeah, I think it would have been more powerful if they had properly established his desperate longing for Aslan's country.
Yes.
But then we go down below, and Drinian is telling Caspian, oh, you should turn back, you're never going to find the blue star, blah, blah. And there's a very telling moment, I think, where Caspian then says, you know, well, we shouldn't turn back, or maybe you want to be the one to tell Lord Rince that we're going to abandon the search for his family. The reason I say that's a very telling moment, because it becomes very clear that this is the true point of the mission now. It's not about the Seven Lords anymore. And I just think that there are a number of things Caspian could have said. You know, he could have said, no, we're not going to abandon the lords. He could have even said, no, we must destroy that green mist and save the people, mm-hmm. whatever happened to them. It's still not very clear. I think the one he picked about, oh no, we can't tell Lord Riddance, he would be too upset, is probably the weakest one. What were your thoughts on that scene?
Fully concurred. And I think that even with the story they were trying to tell, the different story than the story in the book where they set off to find seven lost lords, and then it mainly becomes a quest to discover the end of the world and possibly even Aslan's country.
They do set out to find the lords.
Yes,
and
they do.
After the Lone Island, it drastically shifts course towards the seven swords.
Yes, yes, it does. And even if they were trying to tell that sort of story, as you were saying, Caspian could have said, Well, perhaps you'd like to explain why we can't destroy this dark island and stop this vague shadowy threat, and instead it becomes a quest to put a single family together. I think that may have revealed more than they would have wanted to about who they were trying to market this film to. Because of all of the return to magic, return to Narnia motifs and all that, because of the fact that by and large these are families who are they hoped it would be going to see this film. The priorities then shift. We are now no longer off even on a quest to do something, which tends to be a bit trite to family moviegoers. This is a quest now to preserve the institution of the family. And I think of some of the soccer moms' hearts out there going, "Oh, they're trying to put this family
It's
together."
so cute.
Why didn't Caspian say something as he did in the book? When they were wanting to turn back from the Dark Island, and Reep Pratheep is saying this would be a great impeachment on our honors, and then we didn't come here to look for things useful, but to seek honor and adventure.
Right.
At Caspian, who mostly the film got right, could have said that, and yet it was we're just put this one single family together, which of course the audience has not been given much time at all to empathize with. It is kind of a placeholder, and insert your family here, you know.
Yeah. All right, we go from that to one of the what seems like a huge difference from the book. I mean, I just sort of this next scene just kind of stood out in people's mind is like, wow, didn't really see that coming at all. And it's Lucy's dream, and I guess it's probably the best place to just point out that everything in this next section we're going to talk about is Lucy dreaming. When Lucy's sitting in bed and says the spell, she's dreaming. Then she goes into that Susan thing. She's dreaming. Then she has the conversation with Aslan, still dreaming. And then she wakes up. So she starts out dreaming. Then she goes into a dream within a dream.
Because Tom Cobb and the whole Inception team have her hooked up with the little tubes in the
Or Aslan does. Aslan's got her up,
That's
hooked up
right.
to a briefcase
Oh, there's
somewhere.
a strange mental image there.
Right. But, so then Lucy says the spell, and a lot of fans at that point are probably going, "What? I can't believe she said it!" Then they find out, "Oh, it's just a dream. Never mind." So I guess it's okay.
Shall
But
we
great.
point out? Shall we point out real quickly what was the source material, if one could call it that, in the book? In the book, of course, it's all on Remanda's island. Still, Lucy's reading from the book. She hasn't
You
left the
mean
book. I'm
Koryakin's
sorry,
Island?
Koryakin's Island. Yes, yeah. Some of these details. Maybe I wouldn't be so hard to them. So okay, so she's on Koryakin's Island. She's reading the book. I did not mind them delaying an aspect of the book. It was just the fact that they took this and kind of ran with it in a wrong direction, which I'll talk about more in a moment. But in the book, she sees this vision of what would happen if she did say the spell.
Yeah, she
And
doesn't
then
actually say it. She just sees a vision of what if I said it.
yes, and then all that happens is that Lucy begins to say, "I will say the spell. I will." She knows it's wrong. She makes a conscious choice, and she's about to, but then there's Aslan. His face is visible in the pages of the book. He's growling at her. She instantly becomes afraid. She turns the page, and then later on, she says a completely different spell and eavesdrops by magic on her friends.
And there's all this stuff with the people fighting over her beauty and having wars and
Yes, in
everything.
Calorman and all these other lands.
And so they basically taken that idea of her seeing visions of her being beautiful, and they've m taken that out of the Magician's Book scene and moved it to later on, I suppose, for pacing purposes. My guess is almost everything in this movie was every decision made was driven by pacing, the need to speed things up for
Yes, the
modern
need for
audiences.
speed.
But so here she's having a vision, and she says the spell and walks up, and she sees that mirror and goes to the door, and now she's Susan. And here is Jim Finn and I kind of talked about this in the last episode about overall a good decision to instead of seeing a more beautiful version of herself, she sees Susan. But so he basically is saying this is what has come to be known as Lucy's "It's a Wonderful Life" scene. She's gonna see, "Here's what would have happened if you had never been born, or if you were Susan or whatever." And tell me your thoughts on this scene. I was very caught off guard by this scene. Definitely not expecting it at all. Even though we had one shot from it in the trailer, but out of context, we just had no clue what it was about.
Off guard is a good phrasing, I think. I don't. Golly, when I saw this, I did not know what to think. Well, first, of course, the pacing was just, it was so fast. It was like they just rushed right through it. And even what they were trying to do, but it just seemed so quickly done. And
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like something that weird, it's like either spend time on it or don't do it. That was kind of my feeling. Otherwise, it just seems totally thrown in there.
And just the even the way Peter and Edmund behaved. I think you said something about this before. It seemed almost like overacting. Like, Lucy? Who's Lucy? We have no idea of any Lucy who was here or did exist before.
And I guess that's the point. I guess they're trying to make, oh, this is a total fantasy, you know, I guess is what they're kind of going for. I guess they wanted it to get a little bit absurd. And when I saw it, the audience laughed a little bit. I think they were probably supposed to. A lot of Narnia Webbers, I might even say the majority of Narnia Webbers seem to like this scene. I don't really go glancing through the forums. No one really says why. A Warrior for Jesus, one of our regular podcasters, he actually liked this scene a lot, he says. Though he had, but then most Narnia Webbers had problems with Aslan's words following. We'll talk about it in a second. And for me, it's like, okay, I see what they're going for, moving, you know, Lucy's vision to here, and maybe the idea of it could have worked. I just personally found it a really, really cheesy and kind of obvious too. And that's really all I have to say about it. Maybe you should head up talking about the speech that I guess you could call it, or Aslan's little lecture he gives her. After, you know, she like, no, stop it, stop it. And she like, you know, appears back on the Dawn Treader. And Aslan has some quotes that I don't think were your favorite quotes in the movie.
No, eclipsed only by his very similar quotes at the end of the film to Reep a Cheep. Very human empowering type language. It is not like Aslan, not like Aslan in the book to appear to someone and say things like, "Well, you shouldn't be so hard on yourself. You should be who you are. And aren't you great because you know, you discovered Narnia first? Don't run who you are. You're amazing. You're a brilliant human being." And yes, Lucy is great and all of that, but that is because Aslan has been working with Lucy. Aslan chose, for whatever his reasons, to call Lucy into Narnia first through the wardrobe and to make them all kings and queens. And you get the idea.
Aslan does say in the Silver Chair, "You would not have been calling to me unless I had been calling to you."
And if one understands Aslan's character from reading not just The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, but all the rest of the Chronicles of Narnia, you will see that even when you don't see him, he's very clearly in charge, and he's very clearly writing his own story, and he has his own agenda for these people. And he's, you know, for lack of a better term, he's sovereign. And the reason why he would say anything to Lucy about not wanting to be someone else or wish herself away or anything like that should be more like Lucy. And some people have complained about this scene and they've said things like, well, it's humanistic. I wouldn't call it that. It's closer to being, in theology terms, it's closer to being Pelagian, but I won't get into that. It's kind of complicated. But this is very much a version of Aslan that's foreign to readers and Narnia fans, and even if they don't know why, they just think it doesn't sound like Aslan.
I mean, I think that my reasons are much, much simpler than yours. I just thought it was very hollow.
Well, there's that
It's
too.
just the kind of lines I've heard in just about so many movies. You know, believe in yourself. Don't run from who you are. It's a very safe message. People love to hear, oh, I'm awesome. You know, you should just be yourself. Blah blah. So to me, it was just it was lines that felt like they were written by a computer to me. Just, you know, lifting generic lines about being yourself and throwing them in there. It really landed with a hollow thud for me.
I
And a
think
lot of the
that's
movie
all you're
seems
going to
like
be
that.
left with if you're not understanding, or worse, understanding and deciding not to accept the themes of the book, that here are people who are searching for something beyond themselves, Aslan's country, and instead it becomes seeking for things useful to solve a quest and finding self-actualization along the way. Anytime you ignore themes like that of transcendence, of looking for something outside yourself, an intrinsic beauty that's not in yourself, you're going to be left with this hollow thing.
It's like, oh, that kind of sounds nice. And then that's kind of all there is to it, though.
Narnia reminds us that there are other things more beautiful, more amazing outside of ourselves, and it is worth anything, as Reep a Cheep says, anything, even death, even sailing over the edge of the world
Just for one glimpse of the World's End, Reep a Cheep says he would give his life.
Exactly. Yes, it's about this quest to find the Seven Lords, but the real theme is about searching for Aslan's country. And redemption and other things like that, especially with Eustace. Do you see people, as you're reading on the forum, which you've probably had more time than I to do, you see people saying things like, well, this isn't the Aslan I know? Have they been articulated reasons why?
I think
Or.
so. Not in all, maybe not exactly the way you're saying it, but a lot of people have said this just doesn't seem like it's right for Aslan. And there's been a couple posts going into a lot of detail, and some who actually counter that and don't totally agree with that. But we move on to downstairs where or downstairs, well, down below somewhere. Edmund and Caspian are dreaming, and Edmund is dreaming about the White Witch. Caspian is dreaming about his father, and this is the first appearance of the White Witch in the movie, by the way. So, what are your thoughts on these dreams here? And I know what happens is Lucy comes down. She walks down, and Edmund, kind of goes, either we're all going mad or something's messing with our minds. And of course, it's the green mist that has to creep in and tempt them for some reason. Not sure why he wants to do that. Well, what are your kind of thoughts on this scene? And of course, the first appearance of the White Witch.
Well, there's the upper level of thoughts is that if they'd understood, the book, we wouldn't have had this be necessary, even if they decided to up the ante a little bit. The addition of green mist was just strange. But going down a little deeper, you can see why they did, because there is an idea out there that the main source of temptation is from a thing outside you. And obviously, in the film, they decide, well, okay, well, let's show the temptation. So you'll know if you see the green mist, beware, something outside you is messing with your head.
You look throughout the Chronicles, the flaws with the characters are really, it's their internal flaws. It's almost like they're their own enemy. You look at Peter and his struggle to believe that Aslan's actually there in Prince Caspian. Think about Jill in the Silver Chair, her difficulty trusting Aslan, as a result of the fact that she has no one really in her own world to trust, I think is probably part of it. But it's in throughout the Chronicles very consistently, it is internal weaknesses that are the problem. Here they have definitely taken that and externalized it. Now it's this outside force that's attacking them. They have to resist. The green mist itself, that's one of the big problems with it thematically. As far as this scene itself, again, I just think it's kind of cheesy. And then, of course, has to say out loud, oh, someone's playing with our minds, because apparently they're worried that the audience won't realize something is playing with their minds unless they say it.
Well, as I said before, it was still very, very vague to me. I was confused as to what the green mist was supposed to do. I think it would have helped make it a little more clear if they put little letters across the bottom of the screen. The green cloud could have even been swirled into this little pulsing dot of green, and it could have jumped down and started, flopping across the syllables of the words like in those old,
And those
karaoke
Disney
videos or
sing-alongs,
something.
yeah, because that's about the only way you could make this less subtle and more overt,
Yes, or maybe a
less
neon
interesting.
sign like they used to have in the Looney Tunes cartoons, evil villains hide out here, beep, beep, beep.
When they get to the next island, which happens very fast, this is another issue I kind of have with the movie, is that almost never any time is spent setting up tension over what's coming next. It's like, boom, we're at the next place. So it's a quick dissolve to the next island, which is going to turn out to be Goldwater, never called Death Water, unfortunately. But they go down there, and there's this cool shot where it shows Edmund's reflection that it pans up to him walking. Thought that was neat. Love the design they came up with for Goldwater. It's different from the book, but I like it. I think it was just a great visual.
I agree. Very, very, very different from the book, which describes, I think, a waterfall. Maybe there's greenery, definitely, because Edmund or someone is able to get a sprig of heather and dip it
Yeah, it's
into the
a more
water.
open space.
Yeah, but as a design, I thought it was very unique in the film. Kind of the cliffs kind of had this gold color, actually, and very stark and just kind of desolate. And especially
A little
later when
eerie.
we yes, eerie. And especially later when you catch up to Eustace, we find something that we haven't really seen up to this point is a subtlety. There's a history to this island that we don't know about, and
It's
that
in the middle of
actually.
nowhere, and there's all this treasure. How did it get there?
Which makes the audience ask why, and we don't really get an answer. Lewis actually gives more answers in the book, but in the book, Lewis, and in several of the books, Lewis is a genius, at implying that there's a story here, and you know, I might tell you that sometime. And you know, and a few times, of course, the narrator does his breaking the fourth wall thing, and he actually says,
it
"I'll tell you
makes
that
it makes
sometime."
Narnia feel as if it's not limited to just what's described in the book. There's actually a lot more to it. We're just getting a piece of it.
Yes, there's enough mysteries. It's like also reading in the Harry Potter series of other wizarding schools, and we never actually go to another wizarding school, but we hear they're out there.
Don't give J.K. Rowling any ideas, though. Maybe we shouldn't talk about that.
Hopefully she'll end on a high note and not continue
Exactly.
writing.
But they keep going. I think my issue with this scene is that it kind of loses its eeriness and its sense of mystery because the characters start narrating things that, instead of letting us to play on the mystery and discover things along with the characters start narrating what's going on. Like, you know, like, oh, look at that man down there. Looks like some kind of gold statue. Oh, he must have fallen in. You know, everything is said out loud. So that was my issue with this, is I felt that they kind of set up a sense of mystery at the beginning, and then they kind of lost because the characters just say everything for us out loud. I think even in some ways more so than in the book.
Which you don't need to do in a film, which you might need to do in a book, but even in a book it sounds a little cheesy. The only thing that you might use a dialogue style like that for is an audio drama. And even then you have to be very careful because, you know, people will be describing the obvious and it pulls the listener or the reader out of the story because, okay, that sounds goofy, you know, people wouldn't talk like that.
It's very funny because in the book, I think when they start to figure it out, I think Edmund or someone just says something like, "And that man, he must have." And Lucy cuts him off and is like, "No, don't." You know, they never have to say it. It's almost like it's almost like the horror of it is kind of greater if you don't say it. Just let the audience put it together for themselves. And I find that to be a common problem throughout the movie. We never get that. You know, it's all everything is kind of spoon-fed to us.
Yeah, I agree.
Then you look at like a lot. For example, as far as being spoon-fed, one of the lines that most Narnia lovers really seem to dislike is Edmund saying, "I'm tired of playing second fiddle," and they get into this whole, you know, Caspian and Edmund kind of get in each other's faces. And it's funny reading through the forum, people kind of disagree on, well, was Scander bad? If he was bad, was it because it was a weak script, or was it sort of Scander's fault? People seem to think, oh, this is just a really bad line. I'm tired of playing second fiddle. And again, rather kind of what I was talking about, being spoon-fed everything, instead of letting us observe Edmund, kind of like the way we observe Peter in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and realize, okay, he's struggling to live up to his responsibility as this kind of father figure now that his dad's gone, and he never has to say that in the movie. We just infer it, and we don't get any of that here because Edmund just tells it to us, which is not nearly as realistic or interesting to me.
Which would have made more sense anyway if we had gotten that impression about Edmund before, if we'd been
Well,
the.
let me just say, I think the reason it sort of kind of makes sense is because of the green mist. It's the green mist is tempting them and twisting them around, you know?
Yeah. In which case, because of what they set up with the green mist, it's a bit difficult to win here. Especially when you compare what Edmund does say to Caspian in the book. You know, they do kind of butt heads there over who's the higher king.
And you do get a sense in the book that there might be something going on there. It's not clear, like, why do they suddenly start going out? I really think it's just the idea of something that turns water into gold is wow. You know, they get caught up in the moment and the passion of this discovery and get really carried away. And thank goodness Aslan, you know, shows up at just the right moment and makes them immediately forget it. A moment we don't get here at all.
No
It's
Aslan.
all Lucy. Lucy comes in and saves the day. Salt, this place has tempted you.
I got that impression, you know,
Yeah.
because I saw the green mist in the water. It's like, oh yeah, I know that green mist there. Just saw it
Yeah,
a
every
moment
time the
ago.
green mist
Bad
kind
green
of
mist.
showed up, it's in almost every, not almost every scene, but like any time there's any kind of conflict with the characters, oh, there's the green mist. Okay, so it's not really the characters making choices. It's just the fact that the green mist is sort of doing this to them. It's funny because I think in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the reason they decided not to mention the fact that the Turkish delight was enchanted is because I think they were afraid that, well, you don't just want it to be that, oh, Edmund was drugged and that's why he did all these things. You want to say, no, it was a choice he made. You want it to be a character-driven thing. In the book, we get Edmund's internal monologue. We see what's going through his head. We see his, you know, his resentment towards Peter and everything. And the Turkish Delight, I think, is just more about, well, I guess we don't want to get into this too much if we're talking about Don Treader. But I do think it is, you do get the sense when you read Lewis's internal monologue of Edmund that, yeah, this is Edmund making a choice. It's not just he's under this spell of the Turkish Delight. And
Yes.
I think, so it's just interesting that they did that in Lion, the Witch, and the
They
Wardrobe. They were,
flip-flopped.
I think, concerned about that. And now here, they're doing the opposite, making everything external. Oh, yeah, the reason Edmund is freaking out here is because this evil green mist is twisting his soul around or whatever.
Which is kind of fatalistic. I mean, are these human beings? Are they able to make choices? Can we empathize with them? How do we apply this to our real lives? How do we identify with these people? Because, I mean, when we're being tempted, is there an evil green mist around? I mean, or is it just something that we are doing that's right or wrong? Choices and thoughts that we have. That's what also breaks down the film's ability to draw you in and make you see yourself in place of these characters. It's because, yes, it's a magical world. There's different rules and all that, but what makes a realistic magical world work is
It's got something on
parallels.
its fundamental level that we can identify. Something,
Yes,
an
there may
emotional
be
aspect
magic,
that we can
and
identify as real, even if the world is completely absurd. Overall, I did not like the Death Water, whatever you call it, Death Water. In fact, Reaper Chief isn't even there to give it its name, unfortunately. But I thought that was kind of weak. I thought the discovery of that, oh, it's water that turns things into gold, was, it was kind of okay, even though I wish they hadn't said so many things out loud. But I was really, really upset about Aslan being gone, and now it's Lucy who saves the day instead. That seemed like a really big change to me.
Do you think it was a change because of, well, we're in a hurry here, or we don't have the budget for it, or both, or
I
something
really
else?
don't know.
Just seemed
To me,
not
it
to
just
make
seems
sense.
like how costly could it be to get one brief shot of Aslan? They go, oh, Aslan there. I mean, dude, how about cut out one or two shots of the sea serpent battle and do that? That's what I would do.
Well, the sea serpent battle is very
Oh,
important.
of course.
And well, as I believe you said, at some point they could have at least done like Aslan's voice.
Yeah. That'd be a cheap way of doing it, It would've been better than nothing. But
Yes.
then we cut to Eustace, who's walking away, presumably for the same reason as the book, and he we have the first Narnia poop joke, where he says, "Ruman doo doo," which I didn't. I think it's just very telling about that their target audience being so much more towards kids than the first two films were. I think the first two films, while obviously they were hoping kids would enjoy them, did have a more they were nonetheless more mature overall. So I didn't really appreciate that. Then Eustace comes along and it is confirmed what we all, suspected very early on when we heard the combined islands, that they have combined dragon water and death water, and there's certainly a gold connection there, and also a connection as far as greed being a struggle.
So what we call it, Dragon Gold Death
I think some
Water
people are calling
Island.
it dragon water as.
Oh, Dragon Water. Okay. See, I heard you say Dragon Water incidentally
Oh,
earlier,
okay.
so
See, I keep
it
getting them
must be
mixed
it
up
must have
now.
caught on already.
Yeah, death dragon maybe.
Well, why didn't they combine it then further then? Water that turns things into dragons.
There you go. I remember Rillian was actually wondering about that. We were talking about it, like maybe they're gonna blame Deathwater for Eustace being turned into a dragon, and thankfully they haven't really done that, I guess. But Eustace finds the treasure, and they've unfortunately kind of cut out all the stuff with him seeing the other dragon, and
Yeah, I don't know. Again, it sounds like we're in a hurry here, and and the budget may be smaller than it was
yeah,
for
now I
Prince
think it's just
Caspian.
they were struggling to find a way to, there's so much internal monologue. We see here Eustace and, oh, there's another dragon. Oh, it's mimicking me. All that stuff is all inside his head. And they couldn't think of a way to do that visually. So they said, well, just kind of have it all happen kind of off camera. So I think that's the reason why they decided to have the transformation happen off camera, in addition to seeing an opportunity to get some suspense across. But what did you think about the fact that the gold is not in a cave? It's just kind of out in this sort of like canyon thing, whatever.
Jarring. I'm not sure why it couldn't have been in a cave. I mean, it's not impossible to show the inside of a cave and make it look dark and cave-like while also illuminating things well enough. I just can't help but thinking, because I've read some books about dragons. I'm like Eustace, and why would a dragon keep all his treasure in the middle of a ravine?
Yeah, it's
Or
true.
for that matter, since it isn't even See, I'm trying to remember. I've only seen the film once. Do they even explain that there was another dragon at some point?
No, they don't. There's no indication at all that
So
there's
it's
another
just all this
dragon there.
treasure lying in the middle of a canyon for even less reason. I hadn't thought of that. Well, it does suggest that there's a story here that we won't get to find out about, but I mean, that's a case though where the book, while it does that little whimsical, there's other stories you don't know about thing, this is more of the same where it almost approaches the level of plot hole.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking of plot hole, I think there's also, it's going to be revealed later that the reason Eustace has turned into a dragon is because Dragon's Treasure is enchanted. Which again, this is another example of the enemy, if you will, being externalized. No, it wasn't Eustace who had anything to do with the transformation. It was this evil treasure that was enchanted that did it. In the book, it's Eustace's own dragonish, greedy, evil thoughts Lewis talks about that does it. He basically does it to himself, and in the movie, it's it's again, it's the force is external. So
Well,
they're at least if nothing else, they're consistent at least.
even though you couldn't do all the internal monologuing and things as was in the book, we've seen Eustace be a brat before. It's not a great leap that he would collect all this treasure and get turned into a dragon just because he had evil dragonish thoughts in his heart. Someone could have said something about a legend where that happened, or
Well, I don't know. See,
there was a way to do it without shortcutting it.
here's something where I will cut the filmmaker some slack on that one. And I think the reason they made this change was that, I mean, Lewis just, as a narrator, tells us the reason Eustace was turned into a dragon. Oh, it's because he had dragonish, greedy thoughts. I think they couldn't come up with a way to sort of visually convey that, and I can't either right now. So I think they had to, by having Caspian say, oh, it's because everyone knows Dragon's Treasure is enchanted. That's a much simpler, easy way to get it across. And you could argue, you know what, Eustace did chose to go down there, and he certainly was being very greedy. And whatever the mechanics were of exactly why, what was it made him change, it was his own greed that indirectly led to him becoming a dragon. So I think that does kind of come across, even though the mechanics of it are different. Again, I think it was just a question of visual storytelling is why they changed it. So even though I think maybe there might have been a better way, I will say what the filmmakers are trying to do, I'm in complete sympathy with.
I'll agree with you there. And among all the quibbles that I might have or you might have with the film, this is one of the lesser ones.
Yeah, I
Just
agree.
added together with the others in a kind of a mounting evidence pattern.
We've got Edmund and Caspian realize Eustace is gone, and it's interesting. We get the sense there's still a little bit of tension between them, but they go off looking. And speaking of plot holes, you were talking about before, they go up to the treasure, and for some reason, they are not turned into dragons. And frankly, I would think
Zap.
that if everybody knows Dragon's Treasure is enchanted, that they would avoid it. But they don't. They go up there, and Edmund finds his shoe, and he's like, oh, after moments before, I was complaining about him. And I was like, oh, never should have left him. He was just a boy. Again, it seemed kind of hollow to me. And the fact that, okay, we suspect Eustace might be dead for a grand total of, 30 seconds. And then I think the fact that they don't, I think they're trying to fake the audience out, but because they don't spend enough time feeling like, oh, maybe he's dead. It's not, we don't believe it, because we just know if maybe only subconsciously, if a main character was really dead, they would spend a lot of time on that. Like Boromir dying at the end of Fellowship, they would have a scene really where it happens. This is too quick to really for the trick to work.
Yeah, so what's the point of the fake out is my question.
I think that the fake out, they wanted to add, they like the idea of adding some suspense that maybe Eustace might be dead. But again, I think it's more about the fact that they could not come up with a way to visually convey Eustace being turned into a dragon and his internal thoughts and all that. So they just said, well, let's just kind of have it happen off screen. Oh, and while we're at it, let's add some suspense to the story. I think that is kind of the logic, which actually does make sense. I just think that had they not been in such a huge hurry to get through the story, there might have actually, because I remember hearing about, and then we were reading in re early reports that this is what they were going to do. I remember saying, wow, I think this might work well. It might be interesting to actually think that Eustace is dead if they do it right, if they do it well. And I ultimately think they didn't because they were just in too much of a hurry.
Which the haste makes waste affected the film in a lot of
The hasty
ways.
stroke goes off to stray from Tolkien. That's kind of a common problem throughout this film. So we cut to Eustace the dragon is, there's this kind of a nice moment though, where nice moment of tension where Adrinian and the MLG and Lucy are hearing the dragon, And
The
Drinian, we get
NLG.
the sense that he knows what it is, but we don't know. You know what it is? He's like, oh no, that's no volcano. And there's this epic dragon POV shot where it's rushing towards the Dawn Treader, and we're like, what is it? What is it? What is it? Then it shows the dragon's reflection. It's like, oh, okay, it's something big. It's something big. And then it pans up to a very friendly looking dragon, I thought. I just imagine, oh, how cool would it have been if it had panned up to this fire breathing, really lo menacing looking monster, you know? But instead, I thought the design of the dragon was, although I thought the animation was good and it looked pretty real. I just thought the design of it was a bit too friendly looking. What do you think?
I'm a bit divided on that one because I'm picturing in my head that amazing Pauline Baynes illustration of the Weeping Dragon,
Love that
which
picture,
has
yeah.
whoa, which has just such an emotion to his face. It just reaches right inside you and has such a visceral tug to it. And that may have been what they were going for. I mean, even the color of the dragon is evocative of the Deathwater cliffs before. He looks like, you know, the thing that tempted him, the treasure.
Yeah.
And on that level, it makes sense. I guess I could have been a little bit more disappointed that he wasn't scarier, because then it would have been more surprising that, oh, well, it's useless, you know, or at least somebody would have been surprised.
You know, I just think it's important that he be scary and monstrous, because I think the point of him being dragon in the first place is sort of, I think that it forces Eustace to wake up and say, you know, like the book says, he began to wonder if he was really such a wonderful person as he always supposed. Love that line. Now Eustace looks like on the outside what he really is on the inside. And
Yes, a monster.
he can no longer just ignore that and assume he's wonderful. He's forced to confront it. And so I think if he, I just would have liked it. It just would have been cooler and more interesting as well if he'd have been a little more scary looking.
Well, I was about to say that, well, of course, the movie's audience is, you know, families and children and stuff, so they wanted to tone down the scare factor, but they
Oh.
certainly didn't do that later with the
The
sea
sea
serpent.
serpent, yeah. Which I
But that also.
kind of like the design of the sea serpent. That was really
Oh, I
unique,
was cool
yeah.
with that, and I look forward to hearing or participating in the discussion of that.
Yeah.
But possibly that's why they didn't make the dragon also scary, because,
Yeah.
well, again, it's that enemy outside yourself thing. You know, the enemy is the really scary enemy is out there somewhere. You know,
Yeah.
to think of yourself being that horrible could have been just outside the worldview of the folks adapting the film, and, you
Yeah.
know, understandable. But if they'd been paying attention to the book, they would have noticed that sentence you just quoted about how he looks on the, you know, or the concept that he looks on the outside how he really was all along. But maybe they just thought, well, it would be redundant to have two
Yeah,
scary
well, it may be
monsters.
it was done for rating purposes, but yeah, I think it is a problem, you know, whatever their maybe even if it couldn't be helped, I think it is a problem nonetheless. The whole way that moving on here, the whole way that Eustace can communicates the fact that he is a dragon is very different. In the book, he stands between them and the ship, and there's a great moment where they're all going, you know, swords drawn, arrow to the string, and the dragon is actually backing away in fear, which is not the behavior they expected. And then I hear, you know, Eustace is, you know, flies over to the Dawn Treader, and Eustace, sta I'm sorry, Reaper Teep stabs him on the finger, and then you know, Eustace freaks out and picks up Edmund and shows this big long fire thing he's written that says, "I am Eustace," which well, what were your thoughts on? Let me just, I'm not totally sure myself, but what were your thoughts on this change? And this whole sequence is added where he's carrying Edmund around.
Yes. As a change, okay, let's pretend that all the rest of the film was a fantastic adaptation. If that were the case, I'd have no problem with the change, because it is such a minor thing. And in the book, it's easier to show the tension and carry it through with this extended dialogue with Eustace on the beach. You know, he's backing away from them. There's a lot of tension. You know, a dragon's landed on the beach between us and the ship, and, you know, there's a lot of tension and warm up. Well, we gotta face him, you know, this is our time of chivalry, and they go do that. And it works in a book. It may not have worked in a film. But it sort of sets the tone for the rest of what they decided to do with Dragon Eustace. Instead of having him, yes, he repents, he helps them, you know, he finds the tree for the mast and all that, all this before they leave the island. But ultimately it turns out that it's not to benefit Eustace at all, because he may have to stay behind. He's going to be a complete burden to them, just as he was before. And what they decided to do in the film was make him into this great help to them. In fact, they couldn't have done anything if it wasn't for Eustace.
Which
Eustace
it,
is
it,
amazing.
Yeah, I guess we'll talk more about that in the next one, in the next podcast. But
This sets the tone for that. Is that Eustace is he's got to show his chops. You know, so wow, look what this dragon can do. He can breathe fire. You know, he can pick someone up and swish him off.
Yeah,
I
think a big
mountains.
Part of it is they just really wanted to. Kick the movie into the next gear at this point. Oh, let's have an exciting, instead of a very kind of heartfelt, emotional reveal. Oh, let's just do a fun, epic chase scene. Not chase scene, but you know, more something more intense. Especially, it's also changed in the book. We know that Eustace is the dragon. The characters do not. And here we're kind of going, what the heck is this dragon doing? You know, and then we see it. And though I kind of wonder if the audience, how many people in the audience will know. Oh, Eustace means that brat, because I know that we've heard the name Eustace, but I just wonder if people look at that. Because a lot of people, I remember my little brother had heard the books on tape for a long time. And I remember when he read them, he was like, oh, that's how you spell Eustace. And I just, so I just wonder how many people look at that going, I'm what? Then later, oh, they figure it out. But yeah, I guess I just found the books way a little more emotional and interesting. That's kind of.
I wouldn't have minded if Dragon Eustace had attacked the ship and even, you know, fire some arrows at him and such. If he had then landed on the beach and they would have that whole scene, but as we've pointed out, they were in a hurry and it was a way to shortcut it. Okay.
Yeah,
oh,
I mean, it probably takes
this.
About the same amount of time. It's just that this is more fast-paced and exciting, you know.
Yeah, and we've got to have fast-paced and exciting, and I don't mind that. It's just there was such a moment there. It could have been amazing if you brought that to life on the screen, not necessarily verbatim, but. It was there's such a tension there, but tension takes a while to build up, and that's a lot of time. So
we're over halfway through the film now, so hopefully we can get through this in a few more podcasts. But Ransom, thanks once again for joining us, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from you again pretty soon.
I look forward to that. Just let me know, and of course for all of our listeners, thanks for being patient with us. I'm sure we picked on a lot of your favorite parts, but hey, we're all friends here. We all like to jaw about Narnia. Post a comment. Maybe we missed something between the both of us.
I'm sure
it's certainly
we did.
Possible. I'm sure we did. But, you know, don't be surprised, too, if we get there in the comments also and argue with you
way. Lewis and Tolkien had some, and all of their friends really had some very passionate, occasionally it would come to shouting when they were reviewing each other's work. And they understood, hey, it's because we're so passionate about this. It's nothing like. You don't have to take it as an insult. You know, Tolkien actually hated Narnia and told Lewis so. And so just, you know, understand that we're all passionate about Narnia, and that's the reason why, you know, we can get so into it sometimes.
Right. Well, we should just be glad that the good Professor Tolkien has already gone on to his reward and is not spending time on the internet posting comments, because the moderators would have a time with him picking on Narnia on Narnia Web for sure.
All right, well, thank you very much, Dr. Ransom.
Thank you very much, Glenn Puddle.
I'm sure we'll be seeing you in a later episode.
All right, I look forward to that, sir. Further up and further in.
Bye.
You see, Lucy, you've really lived a wonderful life.